Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Arcademia podcast, where today we'll be doing the third and final instalment of the journey to becoming an architect in the UK. We're back with Adam Morgan and Jack Johnson, as always, to give us their insights.
Are we leaving that take in?
Yeah. And let's get straight into it. So we finished the last podcast on getting your masters and tips to help people in achieving that. So you've now come out to your masters and you're going back to practice life and then hopefully building towards that part three. So just initially going back after your masters, your roles changed in the practice. Was it easy even to get back into practice? Did you have roles lined up or did you have to go and find work? And then just give us a bit of an overview of that, stepping back into practice life after that and your role.
It probably wasn't as easy as it has been for people getting roles when we came out for a second time, because we were still in a bit of a recession, weren't we? So it was still quite difficult.
It was the effects of 2008, wasn't it?
To get a role. So you had a role quicker than me, didn't you? Because you'd already like forged a good relationship with K2, and so your position was pretty much lined up with them.
Why are you smirking?
Enjoying the conversation.
My return to employment is quite interesting in that it was a competition win, Colvin Bay. I call it an advantage in a way. In the Christmas between first and second semester of sixth year, I was asked to sort of contribute because of my relationship with that practice. I was asked to contribute to a competition on the premise that the creative juices were flowing while I was at uni, and we ended up winning it. And my first job in practice was a competition that we'd won. Amazing.
If you hadn't won that competition, do you think you'd have got the job?
No. It was literally on that. It was on that premise. And the reason I wanted to jump in there with that was that's how hard it was to get a job.
Yeah.
At that point, it was exactly what Jack said about. It was mega competitive at that point, and it was that the practice said that the only, I don't say anything wrong with mentioning the practice, but anyway, they said that basically, they wanted, I had a relationship with them at BDP, they'd gone up on their own, and they said, we'd love to take it on, but we just haven't quite got the capacity, haven't quite got the work there. We quite fancy this opportunity, and the work will be there. There's nothing untoward about it.
And mine was slightly more delayed. So weirdly, I ended up doing a bit of work for the same practice with Adam, because we were looking at the Everyman, weren't we?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
The time. And then the bus ferry happened, so I sort of got a bit of a role there for a few weeks and then got offered the job while I was there. And then, I then started my role probably a couple of months after you, didn't I?
Yeah.
I think you were a few months.
And yours was A2 and mine was K2.
Yeah.
Pure fluke.
So, stepping back in then, so, as you said, yours was like a quite conceptual scheme, but did you feel straight away, Ads, that when you went back in, there was more responsibility being put on your shoulders immediately? You were expected to be at a higher level.
When you do your part one, the expectancy is contributing to drawings, contributing to Photoshopping, SketchUp, it's just contributing. It's just, you're always getting looked after. I had this fear that you needed to understand a project in full and construction, because you don't really get taught. You get taught principles. You get taught principles. And from what I'm seeing, because we still obviously engage with the unis, from what I'm seeing now, that it's improving. It is getting more strategic. There's structural strategies. There's ventilation strategies, sustainability strategies and stuff. But you still don't know how to detail, proper 1-5 details. And I remember coming out and feeling that I need to learn that. I need to learn that straight away, because that was the biggest gap. And I think there is a bit of a pressure to understand a project a bit more, because you haven't got the comfort blanket of going back to uni, have you? You have got to progress in that way. So I think it does feel different. And I think it is different.
It's a different pressure, isn't it? Because the first time you're in practice, you don't know the software, but now it's just taken as read that you do. So it's basically when you, it's similar analogy to passing your driving test. You don't really learn to drive until you pass through you.
Yeah.
And
so were you both put underneath someone more senior still though? So you weren't sort of expected to go straight back in and be running the show. You were sort of given a line manager, someone a bit more senior than you, that was just keeping an eye on you, coaxing you in the right direction.
You slot into a team. The difference was obviously me and Adam were used to working in massive practices. So we went from like a massive practice where
hundreds of staff.
The infrastructure was there at every single stage to figure it out yourself. And it benefits you in the end because you basically get thrown in the deep end.
Back to that independent learning.
Yeah, a little bit.
So even though you have got a line manager, you are expected to, have the initiative to go and research details yourself, figure out where you need to get better in order to contribute more.
I think that's more pronounced in smaller practices because, as Jack said, the infrastructure isn't there for the constant coaching and stuff like that. But I'm a believer that that's better for you.
Yeah.
Because you need that eventually. You do need that. No matter how big of a practice you work at, you will end up at a point where you're sat in a room and you've got to have an answer for something. Yeah, And you've got to think on your feet. And whether thinking on your feet is deflecting the question well and in a professional way or answering it direct. Either way, you've got to have your initiative.
Yeah.
And you can't, I don't know whether you can teach that necessarily. You've got to just
It sort of expedites your progression being in a smaller practice, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Who was your mentor at your one? It was a director, wasn't it?
Yeah.
At yours. Yeah.
So you two both had the ambition in yours as well. I think that this is something that sometimes differs person to person. I've known you throughout this process, so I know that when you two passed your masters, you were wholly focused on when can I do my part three and when can I get to that level and become a fully qualified architect. There are some people who are happy once they step out of masters and they get a job, they're happy to be a part two. The wage is okay, and some people just find themselves being more accustomed to that role, don't they? And maybe spending 5, 6, 7 years in that role before they might want to go on
Robert, in our office.
Perfect example.
And he was quite happy with... There's this... And I think Rob did think this as well. There's almost a bit of an impression that once you do qualify, it becomes all about the nitty-gritty. Whereas if you stay pre-qualified, you stay almost front end of a job. Do you know what I mean? There is some truth in that. Yeah, the nice stuff. Yeah. There is some truth in that, actually.
Yeah.
So once you qualify... It all does change as well, in terms of you get more distractions, you get more distracted from design and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it's Matt, who I worked with at Nightingale. He was actually a lecturer on the Par 3 course, and he said one of the main reasons you do it is someone asks you what you do for a living. You can't define it in one word, can you?
Well, that
you
goes go, back I'm to your point
of,
about...
I'm sort of an architect, but I'm not. But I've got like 2 degrees, but I'm not an architect. Whereas as soon as you pass, you say I'm an architect.
Yeah.
Well, that was your point about we were keen. We were keen to get there as soon as possible. We wanted to address things like that. It's been a life ambition. You wanted to address all that.
Yeah.
But just before we run off with that, the reason I asked you about who was your mentor, something that I would encourage where possible, because this might be rare, but my first mentor, I mentioned about I felt the need to learn detailing, but my first mentor was a senior technician. And I believe that that's the best start you can have in your post-masters experience.
Would you say that's the thing you lack the most coming out of uni then?
Yes.
That's the thing that's taught the least almost, that you don't know how to fully detail different types of construction and different materials even and stuff like that?
Yeah. I'm of the belief that there are modules in uni that could be swapped out for some basic detailing, proper basic in terms of very basic. I mean, proper detailing, but in the basic form.
Yeah.
I don't think you do it, but it's not correct to real life, is it? So you're giving them like detail books and they say detail from them. But in reality, when you're detailing a building, it hinges on so many other people. So you need the structure. They give you a slab and then you're basically skinning it. And then you engage with a cladder and a roofer and they help build.
They set the parameters,
envelope.
Don't they?
Whereas in uni, you try and do everything and therefore you don't do anything.
Yeah.
So
there's an opportunity there, isn't there? I think there's an opportunity. But nonetheless, because there are other facilities to learn that. You could even come out of uni in architecture and do a degree. I'm sure you'd accelerate it. I don't know this for fact, but I'm sure they'd jump you maybe into second year of an architectural technology course or something. You could do that off your own back. Mm-hmm. But if the key point I want to get across is, looking back now, I'm very grateful for my first 2 years really coming out of uni, masters, was under the tutelage of a top senior technician who walked me through that project at Colburn Bay. It was a lovely water sports centre, zinc clad, timber clad, loads of glass, all this sort of stuff, walk on roof. It was complicated.
Yeah,
it was part of a sea defence works and all sort of stuff. And I was just like a sponge. So again, initiative, attitude, a lot of stuff. I could have just sat next to him and learnt nothing.
Yeah,
it really. You know what I mean? But I was just like a sponge. I just kept saying to him, "Oh, what's that? What's that? What does that do?" All that sort of stuff. And he had all the time in the world. These people in senior positions, I've never met a person at any size practice that isn't willing to mentor someone who's willing to be mentored.
Yeah.
The minute someone starts, or you might see people that lose patience with others. I've seen it. I've seen senior architects fall out with juniors and stuff. And the reason being is that senior architect has seen the junior and go, I can't see that bit of attitude in them. They want to achieve great things in architecture. So when he saw that attitude in me, he just looked after me really well for a couple of years, going to all the meetings, going to all the contractor site visits and stuff like that. I felt like I really dealt with that gap.
So that's what I was just going to ask next, actually, is it tied in quite nice. Did you have a plan then? So you're stepping back into practice and you're going, right, the next step for me in my career is doing my part three, becoming fully qualified. I know I'm lacking in these areas that I need to improve in. Did you sort of have a plan where you purposely went, right, I need to have been to several client meetings to figure out how I handle those conversations. I need to have been a focal point on the project where I'm the one dealing with the other consultants, etc., so that when I get to part three, I know how to deal with that and answer those questions? Or is it more just a natural process where someone's going, I need you on this, so you're going to have to be the focal point?
A little bit of both. Sorry to just hijack that one there, right? But obviously, part three, and we talked about this on the way up, the PDRs, what is it? Professional Experience Development record. Right? You've got to complete 2 years minimum in the UK to qualify as an architect. And for each of the two spells you do them, and I say two spells because the traditional way is you fill 12 months at your part one, 12 months at your part two, post-degree, post-masters. I had two different tutors at the RIBA, to help me, through that journey. And the second one, I forget both the names actually. The second one said to me, all your PDRs are only stage ones or three. Simple as that. So then what you do is you go back to the RIBA plan of work. I literally looked through all the roles and responsibilities of a project from four to six. That was it. Honestly, yeah. So I did have a bit of a plan because I was told that my PDRs were so biased towards the front end that I probably wouldn't even pass me part three if I didn't fill those stages in.
Why are they important? What are they outlining, the PDRs?
Go on, it's
literally a diary of every project you're on for 2 years.
And how does that contribute to your passing? Is it given a weighted mark, or is it?
It is weighted. Yeah.
Contributes towards it. So I don't know the exact weighting, but there's a weighting towards having them in order to prove that you've, progressed in a certain manner. So as Adam said, if you're lacking in areas, they're automated and they summarise in hours at the end of them how many hours you've put on bits. So then you can quite clearly see, I've spent like 100 hours here and like five here. So then you go back to the office, have a sit down and say, I need some experience in these areas. And then they try and offer that to you. That's how I found it worked. And it draws out your weak areas and helps you fill them. The problem people do is, and I was guilty of this, I filled them out really good at part one and they were all done. Got a bit lazy.
Real time. That's the point, isn't it? You've done them real time.
Done them real time.
So you're just keeping a diary of your work week on week.
Week on week, that's it, weekly.
As you're going. But then by the time I got onto the par three, I was like 2 years behind. And that was probably the biggest challenge in the whole process was remembering what I've done for 2 years. Yeah. And it's a difficult thing. It's the most time consuming thing of the par three, I found.
If you haven't
done them.
Would you say... So you quite honestly started there by saying probably a bit lazy, but is there an argument that at part two, when you go back, you're busier. So you haven't got quite as much time to fill out your PDRs because you are on projects and sometimes you have to work late. You know, the usual in architecture, you know, you're being worked hard on projects, so you haven't got that time. But your advice is you have
got the time,
and you've got to find it anyway. Yeah, even if you haven't, you have got. It is better to be doing it weekly. Yeah. Find the time
because it's really small chunks weekly. It's just an allocation of hours. You could work on the one job. You could just say, such and such job, stage two, 37.5 hours. Yeah. Bang. That's all long, that's it.
And then a little description description what you achieved.
Of the job, the actions. Yeah.
So I didn't like not do them. I kept the diary, a written one every day.
Yeah.
I just didn't put it into the PEDR format.
Right.
And that was the challenge. If you don't keep a diary or put it in the PEDR format, you've got a task on your hand then when you get to it. And the PDR sheets run for the whole time you're doing the course. So if you take like 5 years to do it,
you've got to show the 5 years.
You show 5 years. So you're just creating more work.
There's a bit of an argument of, because I wanted to come into, you know, the length of time that you guys waited before you actually attempted the part three and the reasons behind that. But I suppose one benefit of doing it as soon as possible, a year, 2 years in, is that you haven't got to fill as many PDRs.
That's a direct one. And you know, your question about what's the point of them? It is just proof. It's just proof. And you can lie on them. Of course, you can lie on them. But generally speaking, it would be difficult to lie on them. I just think it'd be too hard, you know, to kind of come up with an imaginary project, an imaginary task, and stuff. So when you're doing that diary, they do look for covering all stages, because that's the point of qualifying.
Yeah.
You need to be able to. I'm right in saying that the purpose of it is so you can set up in practice, isn't it? That's kind of a little bit of a definition. They cover all the areas that you may just stay in practice in a bigger frame, and you may never execute on some of the stuff you've been taught. You know, contracts and stuff like that. You could stay in a practice and never see a contract, like a construction one.
Yeah.
So the whole point of the part three is to give you all the tools that one day you could set up on your own. And in theory, you've got all those skill sets available to you. If you haven't seen stages 1 to 6, you're not even off.
And your mentor has to sign them off. So it's difficult to lie because you need someone who's, is it in REBA or in the ARB?
You have both. No. So you have an in-practice mentor that then passes comment.
Mm.
At the end, and you know, do they agree or disagree? And then, but they give a bit of critique, and then and then you have an RIBA mentor. I think the alternative to an RIBA mentor is an educational one. So you know, your university can actually class as a mentor, but we prefer the RIBA route because they're the ones who deal with the part three.
Yeah,
and then they then offer a comment as well, and then that was where at the end of my part one, it was just too many gaps, basically, in the latter stages.
So then, because Jack touched on this as well before, the only way to get experience in those areas is then to go to your, you know, practice manager or director and sit down and say, I'm lacking here and I want to do my part three in the next 12, 18 months, whatever.
Mm.
Can you give me work in these areas? If there is no work in that area, in that practice, have you just got to sit on your hands and wait and maybe postpone doing your part three until you've got that? Or is there a way where you could just go for it anyway? You know, lacking that slight bit of experience, what would you say?
It's difficult, isn't it? You'd like to think you're in a practice that's giving you the post stage three. It was different when we done it. It was like A, B, C, D.
But it's still the same stuff.
Did those conversations go well for you guys? Then how did that go when you sat down and said, I need more?
Initially, I was only doing like stage 1 to 3, and then they put people through the part three before, so that it wasn't a massive shock for them. So I basically said, me tutor has come back and he said, I'm lacking here. All me hours are weighted to 1 to 3. So then he just, my mentor just started taking me to site, getting me involved a bit more. And, you know, it took the reins off a little bit when I was ready. And that's sort of how it works.
Yeah. Did you have to have that conversation as well?
Yeah. You do kind of have to declare your interest, yeah. if you like, that you want to be a part of it. You get a little welcome pack and everything from the RIBA, which is nice. You know, when you register your interest, you get a nice welcome pack. It gives you a bit of a timeline. It gives you a few options, which obviously we'll get into, about timing with Part 3, about they have two exams a year and you can defer a few times, which is nice, you know, yeah. if you don't feel ready and all that sort of stuff. You mentioned there about what if you're a bit stuck? What if you're a bit stuck at the front end? I personally think that'd be a rare problem there.
Yeah.
Because most practices deliver stuff. We complain sometimes, don't we, that not enough goes to site because of certain constraints at the minute in the world.
Yeah.
But we've still got jobs on site. We've still got jobs that we're sending our photographer to, haven't we? Still yeah. now. Nice house in Cheshire, end of the month. So even there, even where we're complaining about not enough going to site, we've still actually weirdly got plenty on there. So I think it's a rare one, but it depends on, to answer your question, it depends on how much you're enjoying the practice. If you enjoy the practice, I wouldn't leave. I wouldn't leave to just get experience. That's a bit brutal.
Yeah.
I would say hang on, and there's every chance that
you'll get given
that way will come around. Yeah. We find in our practice that it is cyclical, isn't it?
Yeah.
You end up having waves of planner maps. And then once they all get planning, they all need building.
Yeah, yeah.
So that generally does go in those cycles, doesn't it? So I think hang on and it'll come around. If you're not enjoying it, or you've always been 50-50, then I would encourage you to leave and find that experience.
Yeah. And just to touch on as well, there are costs associated with taking the Part 3. Most of the time, your practice that you're working in, because it benefits them when you're fully qualified anyway, they will cover the costs for doing it. At least one time. I mean, if you fail a couple of times.
Or at least supplement. It does vary, at least supplement, because it does benefit the practice. The number of qualified architects you've got in a practice, it does benefit you.
But don't forget to make sure of your situation that it is either being paid for, or so you know before applying that, if you're subject to any costs.
And what your obligations are contractually, because in our practice, we ask that if we pay for it, they stay with us for at least 12 months, because you've invested in that individual, haven't you? Which I think is only fair.
Yeah. Yeah, spot on. Otherwise, you might have to reimburse the practice then, might you, if you did decide.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so you've given us a good insight there into what it's like being back in practice. There is more responsibility. You're trying to plug gaps, maybe. But then, was there a time for you two where you sort of knew and you were like, right, I'm signing up, I'm doing the Part 3?
I don't think I was ready. So basically, we signed up at the same time, and at the time, I was like, I'm not ready, but I'm just going to do it. And I'll only know once I get into the process. But the process is designed to make you ready. So you think you're not ready, you start doing the course, and it's lectures. So the lectures inform you and empower you to be ready. So then by the end of it, you're given a knowledge base to build upon then. And I think what I ended up doing is I took it all very seriously, and then I bought every book on the reading list, went on holiday and read them all, which is probably not for some people, but I've got one of them weird minds that I can work like that. So I ended up reading every book. So I knew a textbook version of how it should be done, how it was actually being done in my office. And then I sort of then came up with a hybrid of the two.
So when you signed up, you know, obviously, as you say, the course does teach you a bit about what's coming, so you don't need to know it all. But did you have an idea of you knew that you needed
stay
to
on your own side?
You knew that you needed to produce a case study. You knew you knew there was going to be an exam. You knew there was going to be an interview. So you start to sort of, you mentioned there you read loads of books. What type of books were they, and why were you preparing in that way?
So to pair it back a bit, I wasn't naive to the process, because when I worked in Nightingales, the guy who sat next to me was doing it.
Right.
So I sort of shadowed what he was doing through it, and it was quite overwhelming watching him do it. Then when I got a Part 2 placement, historically, they'd done it with quite a few people before, so all their past information was on the server, their like case study, their PDRs. So I made it my business to sort of read as much of it as I could, so I was informed with as much information. That did worry me, but then, as I said, the point of the course is to then strip away that worry and make you more ready as it progresses.
Yeah.
So I knew I knew you needed a CV, you needed PDRs, you needed a self-reflection.
Yeah. Self-assessment, I think it was called, yeah.
It's your tax return.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Self-evaluation, maybe.
It is April, isn't it?
His mind's on the tax.
Appraisal. Did you say appraisal? I think it's a self-appraisal.
CV, self-appraisal, case study. And so I knew what I needed to get out of it eventually.
Mm.
And yet I wasn't totally naive to it. And I went into the par three, eyes slightly open. You enroll in like the January, isn't it?
Yes.
December or January. And then you basically start and it takes you up until September then.
And that's when the interview and the exam are?
Yeah. So the exam is September and then the interview's a few weeks later. But you do two residentials. Ours was in Chester. I can't remember the exact date. It was like Feb. I remember one was really cold, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So there was like a Feb one and a summer one.
Which was great. Just explain what a residential is.
So you go to Chester for like 3 or 4 days and you stay over and you basically do full days of lectures.
It's like a boot camp.
It's hard.
You live there. You live there for like the weekend, don't you? It was mad.
Yeah.
It was good though. It was good.
Yeah.
What about you? How did you find that? You know, signing up, enrolling, you know, what was your experience?
I'm just going to digress a little bit because I'll forget it. You know, you said there about when you were at your part one, you saw someone doing their part three. You know, just one mad thing that people might be going through at the minute, listeners, is isn't it so intimidating when, you know when you see one or two steps up the ladder in your career progression to becoming an architect. I don't know about you, but I looked at it and gone, I don't think I'll ever get to that level.
Yeah.
But it's only when you're in it, you know what I mean? So I just want to sort of say to everyone there, just don't panic about those steps ahead, because when you're in it, it's nowhere near as scary. But when you're seeing someone do their part, I forget who it was in my practice, but I saw someone doing the part three. It might have been Ed or someone like that. I was on my part one at BDP and there was a top architect in there and he was doing his part three. So I was part one at BDP and he was doing his part three. And I remember seeing all the books and the documentation, all this contractual stuff. And I was like, whoa, I've got no chance, absolutely no chance. But then when you naturally get to that point, you have got a certain, as Jack said, you have got a certain awareness.
Well, your submission ends up about 500 pages, but you don't produce that in a week. It takes you a year to do, because probably 300 pages of it are PEDRs, aren't they?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So when you first see that, it's crazy. But so sorry, just wanted to sort of get that across, because it's just a weird feeling that every step of the way you see someone on that next step. You just naturally do, don't you? You're always seeing someone in the next step and you see it, and I think it's quite intimidating. But in terms of the process of signing up and stuff, I thought it was very good. And there was the course leader, a lady called Alison, was amazing. Absolutely amazing. She made things as easy as could be in terms of when you apply, all the communication generally either comes from her or her office, you know, so it could be an assistant or something, but generally comes from them. And if you've ever got a question, I do remember the process being very, very seamless because of it. You just, or her team, where you just ring up and say, oh, I don't know about this, I don't know about that. There's certain questions in the form that, you're terrified of getting something wrong, even in just applying for the thing.
Yeah.
So you just ring up, and I do remember them being very accessible, very engaging. And as you say, before you know it, you're in Chester doing the boot camp. Remember the queues for the food? It was massive, wasn't it?
Like, food's amazing.
The food was amazing.
But I put on a bit of timber.
Like the food. But it was north and south do it differently. I'm not well versed in the south of the country, but I believe the north one is a lot more broken up. I think
the south is exam based, isn't it? So you sit like an actual.
It's almost like a mock test.
Exam.
Yeah.
So you
throughout.
Whereas ours is more, you develop your skills through the written work and you do an exam at the end. But I could be getting this wrong, but I found a lot of Southerners come up to the north to do it.
So it was mad busy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So as I'm saying, so the queue for the food, because it was like a canteen, you were there for about half an hour. Because there was a preference. There was a preference to do the Chester crash course because it gave you, it gave you a bit more breathing space, as Jack said there, to develop your skills, develop your written work and stuff like that. More coursework based, and then it culminated in the
exam. It's open book, isn't it, as well, the Northern one.
Yeah. I dread to think what it was like during COVID because it would have all been online, wouldn't it?
I think personally, we've got a friend, haven't we? Who is choosing to not do the exam at the minute because of other constraints. But he did sit through the lectures during COVID, and they were all video call. And I think that was must have been really damaging. I think that if it's possible, I would actually encourage people to go back and do that process again because. Yeah. We were put into groups, weren't we? So we met all different kinds of personalities, big and small practice. I'll tell you one thing that we discovered, that the bigger the practice is not the cleverer the person. Because we were more engaged, weren't we, in doing fee letters and you know, meeting contractors. And you know, we were because there was no one else in the office for it to be in front of. So you were thrown into it.
Yeah.
And So you could see that I think there's a little bit of an advantage there in being kind of small, medium practice, definitely for that spell.
If you're quite an autonomous person, a small practice is best. If you're not, a larger practice is better because it gives you the structure to sit within, to pass it.
Well, we discussed before about when you leave uni, where are your knowledge gaps, etc. And we were talking about, again, architectural items like details and stuff. The biggest one is probably contracts and fees and all the admin side of it, isn't it? Because that's a big part of passing
people management.
Passing your part three, you need to be able to do that.
Well, it's called the advanced diploma in professional practice. So the design stuff, it's great and you reference that through your PEDRs, but it takes a back seat because this exam isn't about that. It's about showing your knowledge of contracts, you know, fees, as Adam said, and
dealing with situations.
Yeah.
You know, you have to describe in your case study how you dealt with situations.
Yeah.
And it's not really design based. It's emotional intelligence based. You know what I mean?
And that's the biggest difference between the case study and the PEDRs. The PEDRs are a diary. The case study is a critical analysis. And sometimes that gets lost on people and they write it like a diary and then you're not going to score very highly because...
Yeah,
that's not the point of that. That's covered in the PEDRs.
Mm-hmm. So again, bringing it nicely then into the next point. So we've discussed PEDRs and what.
It's
and
as if we've skipped it, isn't it?
How to deal with that?
It's a little bit like that, isn't it?
But then, obviously, then now we're touching on case study. So again, just for you two, when did you start thinking about that? When did you start writing it? And what was that process like?
Well, I quite naturally had a job I was already working on at the time, so I discussed it. You basically have to write a one or two page synopsis on your case study, and you give it to your Part 3 mentor and say, this is what I'm thinking, and they either say no.
Well remembered that. Yeah. I forgot about that.
And then you go to them, and then you basically have a good start on it.
You were worried, weren't you? Got to be careful with because a lot of the back end of projects is quite confidential, actually. But cut a long story short, you were wary that your project you were on was unorthodox.
Yeah.
Right? Let's just leave it at that, right? It was unorthodox. And you were wary that you then couldn't write the case study in a kind of traditional way.
Yeah.
I remember the mentor said, this is gold because that's the point.
Because I didn't have a contract. Mine was... So on my job that I was using as the case study, there wasn't a formal contract between the builder and the client. They sort of just agreed it.
A bit of a gentleman's agreement, wasn't it? Which happen.
Yeah. So I had to write my case study in a way that what contract should have been used, what went wrong, how did you deal with it, how would the contract have dealt with it? So I had to make my own structure, which... probably helped me write it in the end because it gave me
It almost forced you down the analytical route, didn't it? Because you had to say, in the presence of a contract, this dispute would have been resolved like that.
Via clause such and such.
Yeah.
It wasn't, but this is how it was dealt with. And
so is that the main point of a case study, is showing your ability to execute on a contract, on a project,
no.
and make sure that it lands?
No.
Or So, because the things that you're talking about here are you're saying you had to describe in your case study how the project was going, how it would have went if it had a contract, but actually how it ranked because it didn't. So what are you trying to get across in your case study?
Good question, because that's obviously what I was just touching on the way up. That you asked us about, is it about contracts? And that's because we've naturally gone that way, haven't we? I think the reason we've gone the way towards contracts is, again, that speaks to the knowledge gap. I think that's why we've gone that way with it. Everyone, one should, at the point of doing your part three, you should know. You'd be really struggling if you don't know what the kind of analysis is needed for stage one, two and three, really. They're the designy ones. It's when you move into four, five and six that you then need to address contracts, obviously technical design, all that sort of stuff. But the purpose of the case study is we were told that if you hit these three areas, you'll pass it, basically. And then we went off and we wrote every single section in threes, didn't we? We were just dead deliberate with it. Why not? You know, yeah. They told you, this is how you do it. This is how you should think it. So we then started creating these three titles, which I will say in a sec.
It gives you the structure in the Par 3 handbook as well, doesn't it? So there's absolutely no excuse to write it any other way than the structure they tell you, because they give you an actual book.
That tells you how to
write it.
The man.
Yeah.
And so the three headings were what happened, literally, matter of fact, what happened? What is the best practice? What should have happened by the book? And then number three is some sort of compromise where, okay, this is what happened. There wasn't a contract. What should have happened? It should have been a contract, right? Mm. But the analysis is number three. And the analysis is, okay, you've got to have a bit of empathy there. The textbook is very rarely possible for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So in the absence of maybe a lengthy contract or something like that, what should have gone on? Well, at least a written agreement. That analysis, you know, yeah. the analytical thing is, okay, I understand that maybe a full-blown contract was a bit excessive for this job. By the way, it isn't, just for everyone's benefit, there should always be a form of contract. There is such a thing as a minor works contract. So there should always be one. What I'm saying is a good critical piece of analysis would say, okay, here's the disputes that arose. And I think actually we could have dealt with them in these ways. And then you show other alternatives. And if you can show other alternatives, the call on real world experience, that you're already demonstrating that level of understanding to pass the part three.
Sorry, I need to sneeze. Yeah.
Do it all with it.
It's gone.
So that's the purpose of the case study, critical thinking.
So like, and those three headings that you gave there, everyone take notice of them, because that is how you write it.
It's all you need.
But that applies to each stage. So you go stage one, those three headings. Stage two, those
just,
like that.
Just read the handbook, because it's not that simple.
Yeah.
Let's just pack the podcast in now then.
No, but in layman's terms, you know, for someone to look and where to start, that's a good place
to start. It's a Par 3 handbook. I forget the guy's first name, but it's something Backhouse. And
Backhouse or Brookhouse?
Brookhouse or Backhouse.
I can't remember.
It's an RIBA book.
Yeah.
How to do your Par 3. And it's invaluable. But to go back to the first stages, because you said there about making out those three headings, I use the contractual one because it's an easy one to use the headings that.
Yeah.
Because you're saying if there isn't a contract, what to do and all that sort of stuff. But on the design aspect, you then go into the initial stages, stage one, you go into appointments. That's a contract, isn't it? That's a professional services contract with clients and architects. So you go into things like, was there a proper fee appointment? Was there a proper schedule of services? If there wasn't, what could have done better? So you can still apply those.
Like stage two, for example, you recommend to the client, just as an example, is this something that would work? You recommend to the client that you need a structural engineer appointed at that stage, acoustician, you know, several other consultants. In the real world, a lot of the times the clients won't want to appoint them because they're still looking at the land at risk. Mm-hmm. So they will, you know, 5 times out of 10, say at least, come back to you and say, I don't want to appoint them yet. I want to wait until stage four to appoint them. So then you're writing in your analysis, we recommended that the client get this information in now so we can freeze the design quicker. However, they couldn't afford it, whatever. So we've had to appoint them later down the line. What could have been done better is they should have just appointed them because then would have saved everyone time, money, etc. You know, something along those lines.
Yeah. But and this, you know what? It's a good point you touch on here, because that how you've just described it is actually blurring the lines between heading two and three. Heading number two is best practice. They should have appointed them.
Yeah.
Heading number three, you could still continue down that path. You could still say, my analysis is they should have appointed them, yeah, and end of. But I think personally, you would score better by saying, okay, there was no appetite for consultant fees at that point because of X, Y, and Z constraints. You could then, in the analysis, say something like, "We could have went back to the consultants and asked them for maybe a stripped back service."
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
That's the compromise. So think of the analytical bit as an element of compromise between non-textbook and textbook.
Yeah.
That's a great way of dealing with the critical analysis. Go, and this is what we do on a daily basis now, isn't it? We've got great relationships with tons of consultants, and we say, okay, your main fee to do a proper job is 10 grand. What service could you provide for, say, 3.5? Could you give us high-level comments?
It's mainly M&E at that stage, so you just need a spatial plan.
Where's my plant room going? Yeah. What's a rough size? So you're not chipping the consultant's fee. You're saying, how can you still make your money at this level? Give what would your scope look like at that level? That is the best way to do with it. You then go back to the client and say, that's the recommendation. In your case study, you can stop there. Mm. In the real world, that could go on forever. In the real world, they could say, well, I still don't even want to spend 3.5. But for the case study, you can stop at the critical analysis is, here's what should have happened in the absence of textbook.
We can probably make our case studies available, but we'd have to redact a load of the info. But it's probably something we can make available.
Well, yeah, maybe we'll... We haven't done this yet. Yeah. We'll link it in the comments below.
Well, yeah, and obviously anyone who's currently enrolled and going through this process, always feel free to reach out to us, because the guys are more than happy to share their experience and help where we can and advice.
Yeah. Oh, yes, what's on?
So then, case study, do you complete that first, that gets sent off, and then you start to prepare for the exam and your interview?
You send it off in certain stages, so... if you're getting the most out of the process. So some people will not do a lot and then write it all at the end. But the idea is you write it in stages and you send it to your mentor. He sends comments back, you amend, and, you know, it's a bit of a back and forth with it.
Yeah.
I'd say we done that as well, didn't we?
Yeah, we did actually.
We didn't put... PDRs were a bit all over the place, but the case study we took very seriously. It's a good 10,000 words. It's a... basically, it's dissertation time again. Mm. And we were quite good in that. We did do it kind of stage by stage, didn't we? You know, the three headings every time. And we did do it stage by stage. I felt like, and it's the way to do it. I know it's easier said than done, but it's definitely the way to do it. Do it progressively, because if you're trying to cram a case study in while you're trying to revise, I think we gave ourselves a good 3 months of the case study and then a good 3-4 months of revision. We didn't let one, you know, interrupt the other, because...
Now, as well, just again, slightly off peak, but just to touch on something here, because it's going through my mind as you're explaining it to me now. You've got to do all this while you're still in work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the hard part. Like.
So something that we haven't fully got into yet, and people don't appreciate the difficulty of this, is you're doing a full day's work in the office, working on potentially now some high-level stuff because you've got a bigger role in the office.
Yeah.
You're still learning on the job there, and then you've got to come home and do a dissertation.
We used to just stay in the office.
Back to episode one, where we're trying to get a bit of sponsorship from our favourite brands.
I was going to say before, Pepsi Max.
I don't know what implications are. I was on YouTube last time. We were joking maybe about Coke and Noodles. That'd be a great sponsor. Yeah. Love that. We'll do a little whiz across again. Now, it's a tough one, this. This is a really tough one for me to even say, because in equal measure, I don't want to encourage this attitude. But there's a part of me that to become a good architect with the responsibility that an architect has, why not make the final hurdle, the hardest hurdle possible? Because you have to separate people that don't take it seriously. You know, you do. So I'm split on whether to encourage it or not, really, you know what I mean? So I'll just let people decide. What we did was we did get a pretty much a creative Coke noodles. We just split it in half, put half in his office, half in my office, where we work, not our offices, you know what I mean, where we worked. And we give ourselves, I think, two or three evenings a week. We did create a diary, and we made sure that we covered off different things. There's a few easier ones, like the CV. You just got to do a 2-page CV, easy.
Yeah.
Your self-assessment, easy. You've just got to describe your journey to that point. There are things that you can just write quite freely. Yeah. So we just box them off.
We done them first. Just to get them off the
plate. And then PDRs were just an ongoing thing. Whether we backdated or not, they're an ongoing thing. So we literally split it into case study exam. Because the others, you can just kind of...
The self-reflection thing, that's, for example, your PDRs, you have to be under a chartered architect or whatever. But in the self-assessment, say you've done a foreigner, you'd put it in that because you've done that for yourself, not under someone. So
right.
For our
international listeners, that's a side project.
Yeah.
Slang.
Yeah. For project behind the scenes.
I think they call it moonlighting elsewhere.
Yeah,
don't
yeah that's it. Yeah. That's it, yeah.
Moonlighting. If you're going to moonlight it, go in the other part.
Yeah.
So then what we did was we just got into a mentality of we have to get this done. We're better together. And we did meet a guy on our part three boot camps, you know, the residentials. And we got on with him so much so that we actually said, you know, would you join us? And luckily his practice was only two streets down from both of ours. We were dead local to each other. So then the three of us, we kind of shared the load, didn't we? We whether it was the case study, and because you have to research the best practices for the case study. And obviously when it got to the exam, you have to research past papers and the topics that generally, there's 10 questions, but there's generally about 20 topics that keep coming up, you know, intermittently, obviously. You pick 10 out of the 20. And a great piece of advice is definitely get into that team mindset of giving each other different tasks. You always naturally have a bit of a bias towards certain ends of a job or certain ways of doing things. You know, Jack's like a bedtime reader. Mm. So we were just making sure that he was doing the kind of the background reading. And then he'd come and present to Simon, his name is, the third guy who, you know, kind of helped us along with the part three. And then Jack would just come in and say, right, here's what I've picked up. And you know what? I've seen this appear in X number of past papers. Here's how we answer it. Mm. You know what I mean? So we really go into that. But if we hadn't have allocated those, let's just call it three evenings. And I think it was three because we then just picked each office. We got the permission from the office directors. And we just said from 5:30 till maybe 8:30, something like that, the other two would then visit the other office.
Yeah.
And then we would just have a little break, little mind break. We would have 30 minutes having a bit of dinner, and we'd have a little chat, a little catch up, and then we'd get straight into it, and then we'd pick a topic each time.
That's a crucial bit of advice, I think, is to, again, surround yourself with people who are doing it as well, because each person will just retain little bits of information differently, won't they? I mean, you two clearly are always got different perspectives on things and the way that you do things, so I imagine because you were doing it together, Jack would be bringing things and you'd be bringing things that were different, but then if you're brainstorming together three nights a week, stuff that you might have missed trying to prepare on your own is always getting brought up, isn't it, externally from someone else. So I think that's really good.
I think Simon was a bit more experienced.
He was
well.
Older, wasn't he? So we lent on him quite a lot.
So he had a lot more in practice experience as well. So he brought a lot of value. But I'd like to think that we did as well with him, as you say, with different mentalities, different perspectives. And just another, at the very least, another pair of hands.
And you've probably seen a lot more then, haven't you? So like the things that you're trying to deal with, one of you might actually have seen, say an exam question, for example, you might have come across the exact scenario on your job.
Well, there's no better lesson than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, party war was one I always struggled with.
Yeah.
And you'd sit down and, as you say, there's every chance, if there's more obvious, there's every chance someone's actually dealt with it.
Yeah.
Because it's all good and well having it in theory, but when you've really dealt with it and you've gone through a process, well, you know it then, don't you?
So. Yeah.
I think that's where COVID's been a struggle for people doing it, because you couldn't be in a room with other people, could you?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Video calls are just not the same, are they?
Not when it comes to that, the intensity of that.
Yeah. And not being able to do the course, well, you meet all the people you end up getting along with and in a group on the residentials in Chester, so to not be able to do them, it's
and it's a network as well. You're networking, aren't you? You're networking at that point. You're building a network. You're building a professional network.
Yeah. Which again is crucial once you're fully qualified.
Yeah. So I would say if someone did go through that process, and again, you know, we're trying to reach an international audience, so to charter as an architect is a global thing. It doesn't have to be under the RIBA. There's obviously institutions worldwide. And I think if you have suffered through that COVID period, I would say if you've got that opportunity and you can go back and do it in person, I would encourage it, because there are life lessons to everything that you learn on that. So,
100%. Okay, so case study. You're happy with it? You know, you've spent your three evenings a week doing it. You've got it to a point where you're happy. You send that off. And then, are you waiting then? Is it just a wait until your exam?
No, you don't submit your case study. You submit it all at the very, very final bit.
But you do submit it for comments, don't you?
Yeah.
That's what you meant. That you submit it for comments for your RIBA mentor and your internal mentor.
Yeah, so then you're happy with what you've got. And then you just wait. It's the next stage is wait for the exam. And in that period, are you taking practice exams to get yourself prepared?
Yeah, absolutely. You do past papers, and then your 3 nights a week switches into that. Effectively, you're all doing past papers collectively.
Yeah.
So it's about setting that infrastructure early.
Yeah.
So it switched from case study to exam, but it was no stranger to us that we had to hang on after work
and do that
and still focus
extra
on that content.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So the switch was easily done. But you are right though. Yeah. So you submit it for comment, and you do kind of wait for it to come back. But I also got a bit of extra advice from one of my directors who was my office mentor. His wife was, I think, an English teacher in a past life, you know, whatever. I don't think she was at the time. And he very kindly said, a lay person's pair of eyes on this is as valuable as an expert, because how does it read? You know, is it in good English? Is it, you know, because you don't want it to just be pure technical jargon. You do want it to be quite a nice thing to read, because these examiners are reading tons of them. So you want to make it an easier read as well. So I would encourage actually to not just submit and stop, submit and continue to evolve it. Continue to get the opinions from people outside the industry, people who are good at, you know, written work and all that sort of stuff. And just keep an eye on it. Maybe just once a month, just revisit it. Just keep revisiting how you've analysed things. And that's the big score and one, the third heading.
Yeah.
Keep revisiting it. And there are things that when you're revising for the exam start to pop in as well. You start going, oh, actually, I didn't write about that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I wouldn't say put it away. I would say continue to just look at it.
Yeah.
But you're right though, in terms of the focus shifts on revision and getting a little bit, getting clever. You can't get too clever, but getting clever with what generally are the questions that appear. There are four or five that always appear.
Yeah,
fee.
Every year.
Fee always appears, let's put it that way.
You know what would be mad now? Because obviously we've done our case studies like 10 plus years ago, to revisit them now.
Oh, but it would be awful.
They'd be horrendous, wouldn't they?
They've just got to be good enough, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was it. We didn't go into it to set the world alight. Some people do and they have really good case studies. It's hard enough. So we just went in trying to just get through it, and then you kick on from there then. So get your thing to a point of passing and then go from there.
You're not asked. You're not asked what grade you got. You're asked if you passed or not. That's it.
It's just a pass or
fail.
Are
you registered or not? But one person, I was a bit jealous on the day, I'll be honest. One person gets an honourable mention. One person wins.
Right.
And in the RIBA headquarters in Portland Place, it's a lovely building, of course, it's the RIBA headquarters. Yeah. And they get up on the stage and they're proper celebrating. And I was like, oh, wish that was me. You know, in that point in time, but it's soon forgotten.
Yeah. Valedictorian, I think you Americans call it.
That's it. There you go. That's it. Now you're talking. And but other than that, you just pass and you get registered with the ARB. That's it. So when Jack said there about we just done enough, again, people mightn't agree with that opinion, but you have got enough on. You just have got enough on. So you just make sure that you're definitely hitting the right notes. And it's about pass or fail. It's not about...
With the exam, is it practice makes perfect? So is it just do as many past exams as you possibly can, get as many questions in front of your eyes as you can.
Yeah.
And then the more you do it, the more it just becomes muscle memory. And then when you get it on the day, you're more confident. Were you confident going into the exam? You get sighted the questions how long in advance?
It's changed now because there was a lot of mishandling of exams and all that sort of papers. You used to get it about a week early. You used to get like the, well, you never
you get a scenario, don't you?
You should get a scenario early doors. The scenario gives you clues. It talks about list of builds and all that sort of stuff, you know, so it gives you some clues. But the practice used to get the questions early. And some practices, rumour had it, I've got no evidence, but rumour had it, some practices would just sort of, oh, you know, the envelope was open and some would see it. Ours were pretty strict. They said, if you're ready, you needn't see them early and all that sort of stuff. But now what they do is they deliver it on the morning, digitally. They deliver it on the morning, which is the way it should have always been, to be fair.
Yeah.
You get the scenario a week in advance, so you can sort of start to get a sense of some of the projects. At that point, by the way, you start to get construction value. So you should be making notes of these things. You make a note of, it mentions contracts. Mm. So it does start to say, oh, you know, that job was under a minor work, so that job was an intermediate. So you can start to make these little notes. You can prepare.
And then you need that contract available to you on the day. So don't just read it in the scenario. Go and get the contract. If you need to buy it, great. Mm. But more than likely, your practice will have one on file for you.
Yeah. So then you've got sight of the questions. And it's exam day. What was that like?
Oh,
nerve-wracking.
it's just a long day. So it gets described as like the worst day you can ever have in practice. So like the exam.
Not the exam. It's the content of the exam is mimicking a bad day in the office.
Yeah.
So basically you're in the office and everything that could go wrong. So
it's your ability to be able to deal with that.
Deal with it. Yeah. In a non-robotic way. So you're not answering the questions like as if you've read it from a book. It's their emails, the answers to the questions of you firing an email to someone, and you need to write it as a human effectively, don't you?
It's a good point. It's a tough one to get absolutely right, in that you want to go back as quite relaxed. You want to say, you know, it's like you're sending me an email and I'm replying to you. So if I'm replying back to you, it's quite relaxed. The language is quite relaxed. But you've still got to strike a balance, haven't you? Of you're still trying to address a very serious issue.
Yeah.
So you've still got to write it in a human way, but still try and stay quite professional. But again, I think if you're prepared enough, I suppose the thing that this is a good time to put it in. My definition of being prepared enough is the ability to deal with people, scenarios, you know, things like that. You know, are you confident enough in a meeting to contribute to the meeting, not chair the meeting? Are you in a position? So this would be my definition of being ready. If you're in a big meeting, 20 people, do you feel confident enough to at least just be part of that discussion?
Mm.
If you're confident enough to be part of that discussion, I would say naturally you're ready to undertake that process.
Yeah.
And then when Jack says it about then how it's written, how you're responding to these queries, I think if you can contribute to those kinds of scenarios, your language should be about right, I'd say. What do you reckon?
Yeah, you need to strike a balance, as Adam said, between being formal and, you know, how you'd actually write an email. And I think if I redone it now, the exam, me questions wouldn't be very long, and that would show a confidence in itself.
I agree.
Whereas when you're doing it, you're like, I want to cover everything. So you write, you'll write an email and it's a mouthful. Whereas you probably can answer the question in a paragraph.
Yeah.
Like you would in practice these days, and that's the difference. And then the beauty of it is it all hinges on the interview, really. So say you'd write the most amazing exam questions, your case study is great, and you can't converse on their level in the interview, you won't pass.
Yeah.
So,
and I suppose that's where, you know, you're talking there about the language that you use in the emails. If you can write it shorthand and in human language, it shows a level of maturity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It shows the level of confidence that then you would naturally carry through into the interview.
Yeah.
Because as you say, the next part of that then is when you've finished your exam is to sit down with people and they're going to almost crit you on your answers, ask you why you reacted in those
and
ways.
It's a discussion with peers, the interview, as opposed to, you do get grilled in ways, but you need to be able to converse back to them without like a panic or a big delay.
As opposed to an external examiner at your degree or your master's, the external examiner is the one that comes in and they kind of agree or disagree with the tutor's marks, right?
Yeah.
At that point in time, it's a superior looking at a graduate's piece of work. The difference that Jack's highlighting there is, again, that's what I'm saying about, for me, it's emotional intelligence that defines whether you're ready or not. If you can go into that session and on the opposite of Jack's idea, you could have an amazing exam and a rubbish interview. On the other hand, you can actually rescue a poor exam in the interview.
Yeah.
If you go in with a level of critical thinking and self-reflection where you go in and go, you know what, that question on list of buildings at number 7, I just panicked on the day. Is I would do it differently.
Yeah,
if you can really nail that, you can actually save a failing exam in the interview with a level of maturity.
To tell you that as part of the course, that's the case.
Yeah. Just before then we go into the interview, obviously we want to talk about that. Back to the exam, full day in the office.
Three full days.
It is by definition.
Wednesday, Thursday, and then Friday is collating it all. So actually, 2 full days of 9 to 5 or 5:30 doing the exam questions, and then the third day is basically you then have to package your whole 2 years worth of work.
That's what I was going to say. So the third day is not without stress, is it?
Yeah.
It's full of stress because you're trying to get it all together and get it in the right order, aren't you? And do you remember when we were debating whether you print double sided or not because you wanted it to look thicker?
Yeah.
you want to print single sided. That's what looks like an absolute monster of a document. Ah, yeah. Scare them with, you know, the illusion volume. Of grandeur.
Yeah.
But the exam's two intense days and it goes like that. 8 hours of sitting. You think 8 hours of typing would drag on? Oh, an absolute blink of an eye.
Clock watching every 2 minutes, see how long you've got left.
Yeah, you are. So my advice would be to, and again, it's such a cliche, but it's to plan. Read the questions early. We've as practice owners, we've helped others with part threes. And what we encourage them to do is get in early. There's not stopping them getting in early. Yeah, I think the exam questions landed about 8 a.m. in preparation for 9 a.m. something like that. There's nothing stopping them getting in early and reading the exam and, you know, just digesting it. And then my advice, now this is the way I think Jack might have a different opinion on this, but my advice is to actually deal with the difficult ones first. That feels a little counterintuitive because you want to kind of almost deal with the easier ones first and thinking, but I would pick, it's 10 questions total. It's 5 each day, isn't it? 5 each day. And both days there's a curveball one as well. Mm. So I'm going a little bit round here. So the curveball one I would leave to last. So I would identify the curveball one. And the reason I say it's a curveball is it's a topic that you almost couldn't possibly revise for. It might be a very recent event, or it might be something political or something like that. You know how architects contribute to climate change and stuff. That might have been in a past paper. So I would leave that one to one side, address the 4 others and do them in order of difficulty first. The reason being is I think you're fresher in the morning, so you can deal with that, you know, in a certain way and deal with it in as shorthand as possible. This is something that a lot of people fall foul of. You try and write the answer in full. The third day, you are allowed to kind of embellish your answers as long as you don't add actual content.
Mm.
So as long as the content, so you could just bullet, you could just, in theory, and I wouldn't go this extreme, but in theory, you can bullet answer for the first 2 days and then turn them into sentences on the third.
Yeah.
And the way that's structured is at the end of day one, you used to put it in an envelope, didn't you, and send it off, but you email it now. So where it is at the end of day one, you email it. So then they can compare the differences between your day one, day two and day three content, effectively.
Who's blowing the air horn at the end of the day to set your times up and stuff?
That's a very good observation.
It's email, so it's automated.
Yeah. So you just receive an email saying, stop what you're doing. And
No, you have to have sent an email.
And the email's timed and dated. Yeah, yeah. But it used to be practice at discretion. And that was another grey area that people were like, oh, you know, did they or didn't they do it? Buy the book and stuff like that. Whereas now, it's a timed, recorded email. Mm. I think you have to hit read receipt as well on it. I think because you can do that in Outlook, can't you? You can set read receipt.
Yeah.
I think there's something like that. It's after our time.
A lot of it hinges on prep work, doesn't it? So there's a lot of stuff you can do beforehand. Like you can prepare letter headers because you know what you're in effect working for NDG Architects.
Yeah, so the scenario gives you the brand name and stuff. So you can create a little logo.
You need to make all the template emails, the letters. As that practice, you need Excel spreadsheets to do your fee quotes and stuff like that. And you don't want to be doing any of that on the day. You want to have done that weeks in advance.
Yeah, that's a great point. That was part of our past paper process. Mm. So we did get into a little rhythm of, we didn't let it get in the way, but we got into a little rhythm of, that question always appears. That question always appears. Mm. And we were like, they always ask about programme. They always ask about a fee. Mm. They always ask about staff rates and stuff like that. So we just went into Excel and just started making them.
Yeah.
And just started giving them indicative numbers because the scenario gives you the numbers. So we just started giving indicative numbers, just, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 pounds an hour, whatever. And we started creating them. So then on the day, as you say, it was a case of just filling them in.
Yeah.
Imagine creating that template on the day.
There's a theme with the questions, which is every year, because there's only so much you can write about. There's a planning question where it's a planning consent and normally a listed building thrown in.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's one where you need to talk about bats ecology because that has a time constraint.
There's a
contract question. There's a fee question.
Yeah. Party wall. I've said that.
Party wall. So there's probably like four or five and then they spill into the 2 days and then you have a curveball.
I remember as well, an important one was, I remember there was a difficult question from someone that we knew was doing the part three. And the advice actually that you, I think it was you gave them, Jack, was if you're really struggling and you don't know how to answer it, spend no more time on it. Mm. Almost like a pass on a game show. You know, like if there's a question that you're wasting an hour, 2 hours on because you're really trying to, or you've got it, you're researching on the day because you don't know the answer, just hit pass and go and do the other ones so you don't leave yourself too little time.
Just go on ChatGPT and that'll write up, do it all for you.
I tell you what.
That's something they're going to need to look at now, isn't it?
That wasn't
in play last year.
No, when we were doing it, it was carved in stone.
Your curveball question's done with ChatGPT now, so you don't even need to worry about it.
Yeah.
Not if they get it wrong.
Get on the £20 a month plan.
That'll sort you right out. That's the risk now with AI.
ChatGPT.
How
are they going to govern that?
Well, they'll definitely, and there is always, there's already talk of it, isn't it? There's going to be an AI thingy checker. What's the word? Plagiarising.
Yeah.
There's going to be a plagiarism AI as well. So they're going to be battling each other. Yeah. Anyway, let's not get into the AI stuff. But
I don't know would have been my advice, you know. I think that's been, I'd have probably said have a go at it.
But it might
be. Don't spend too much time.
Sorry, I'd never say hard pass.
No, I was using that as a sort of visual sort of thing. You didn't tell them to just pass. You said you've spent 2.5 hours on something there and the answer still isn't.
Revisit it.
Where it needs to be.
The advice.
Leave that, park that for day three, whatever. Crack onto someone else.
Or you better have a 9 answer, don't you?
Yeah.
than just one.
Answer the ones you know in as timely a manner as possible and give that whatever remaining time you've got.
Yeah, exactly. So going back to my one about the curveball, that let's call that the curveball. So that's what I'm saying about you actually should leave the curveball till last. When I say do the in order of difficulty first, I mean the ones that you should have researched by now, do you know what I mean? So... let's just say, for argument's sake, so my one was, the trickiest one for me was party wall. And the reason being is party wall is very nuanced. So if I could go back and do it again, I might have done it this way, I forget now, but if I could go back and do it again, I would say, right, well, party wall is my weakest. I'm going to start on that. I'm fresh air. I'm going to really hammer into this one.
Yeah.
But equally, the advice is, have that self-awareness. If that's your weakness, make sure you've got a couple of books on it. Handy. It's open book, so you can have it ready. And even though Jack said about he read things cover to cover, that's the best way of doing it. Let's have it right. But that's not me. I get you to read some of my emails.
Yeah. Right?
So that's not me. I'm not a big reader. But what I did do was create a little, you know, those little coloured inserts you can put into books, little sticky ones. What I did do was I gave myself a roadmap for every book. I had a good 10 books around me, if not more, and the contracts. And I made sure I gave myself that roadmap. So the absolute fundamental, you can choose to read through them or not, but the fundamental thing is, on the day, you're going to be panicking. There's no two ways about it. You're going to be absolutely panicking. So you need to make sure that accessing that information is as easy as possible.
The part three, you're not expected to know it. The answer, you're expected to know where to find the answer. That's the key to it.
Yeah.
That is it.
Yeah.
That's the top and bottom of it.
Expected where to find the answer, and again, how to deal with that situation. And going back to the potential of a hard pass, you say we wouldn't advise have a go, but the potential of a hard pass, because that will happen. That'll happen to some. You'll run out of time. That's where you can rescue it in the interview. You can. You really have got that opportunity. They will judge you on that thing about how you carry yourself in the interview. You're carrying yourself as an equal to them.
Yeah.
They will give you the benefits of the doubt.
And in the interview, you can't lie. So if you don't know something, say you don't know, but you'll find out. Yeah. You can't lie. They will see right through
it. That's a great piece of advice, yeah.
So let's get into the interview then. So exam's done, sent off on time, read receipts.
Yeah, that's it, that's it.
And then the interview is a week or so after.
Just about two. It's about two weeks after.
Again, what's it feel like on that day going into it? And is the, can you prepare for that? You know, do you read back through your answers to make sure?
You should be sitting with your in office mentor the week after.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not for the mentor to drive that discussion. It's up to you. You know, the listener, you the part three taker. You've got to engage with your practice mentor and say, I want to sit down with you on that day. I want you to give me an honest assessment and be honest with yourself. Look at yourself over the weekend. Be very critical. Then you have a session with your mentor. They'll know the ins and outs because they've done it before.
Yeah.
You go into the interview with that prepared. That's what you go with. You go with your documentation self-critiqued.
Yeah.
You go with it ready.
So if you sit down with your practice mentor that week, he highlights mistakes in each question. Not mistakes, but, you know, room for improvement on certain questions. You really drill down on that then, knowing that when you go into that interview, you've already self-critiqued it and gone, when they're interviewing you and they're asking you questions around it, you can say, I know I didn't answer that best. Here's how actually I would have dealt with it now with a bit more time.
Yeah.
That's it. A bit more time, a bit more support around me.
Yeah.
Even just going into the interview and evidencing that you've had the wherewithal between finishing an exam and the interview. Even just showing that evidence that I have not stopped.
Yeah.
Between now and this is how seriously I'm taking this.
Yeah.
They'll see that.
It's that level of diligence as well, isn't it? Of like, yeah, you know, I need to know how to figure this out. So yeah. I have, you know.
And that's why it finishes in an interview. It's the ultimate test of character, you know what I mean? And that's why, personally, I don't like the talk of them, like, you know, potentially, you know, dropping it or different routes and all that sort of stuff, because I believe that there should be an element of that baptism of fire, because it's such an important, you know, responsibility.
What's it like then? So where was yours held? And is it a waiting room? Is it like tapping and shuffling your papers?
No, so they make it as scary as possible.
It's a Chester race course. And basically each interview room is one of the boxes that overlooks the race course. So you're stood in a row outside and all next to each other.
Yeah. On a little separate bench and ready
to go into your own individual
and all the doors open at the same time.
And you all start getting called in and it's
how many interviewers are there?
Two. I had two.
When you go in?
Yeah.
So it varies between two and three, because I had three.
Right.
So, and the reason it varies between two and three, I think it's just to do with the numbers, as in, like, you know, it, there's nothing to it.
Yeah.
So don't read into it. You know, we both passed and I had three, he had two. There's nothing in it, because I did think there was something in it. Was I getting more critique because I was borderline? I don't know. You know what I mean?
But I had a nightmare in mind. So obviously, you know who your interviewers are.
So you're told ahead, don't you? So you start looking.
So you
into
start
them.
Researching them. So basically, I had a photo of each one printed, so I knew who I was addressing. So it took that level of scrutiny out of my brain, like, who's who? Oh,
well, and again, it shows
the photo fell out.
On
the desk. So I looked.
So they knew that you were like.
No, so.
You had like strings on your wall.
Photos outside the houses.
So yet the photo of one of them slipped out of me thing, and I just went, yeah, been doing my homework. So I made light of it, but.
Oh, but I actually think that's good if that was me sat the other side of the table.
It's a bit Joe Goldberg, though.
No, yeah, it's a bit of psycho about it. But yeah. I think I'd be looking at that going, this is a really diligent person. You know, this is someone who
I think ultimately
does research everything.
Would
you know, I would be a bit scared, but
yeah, yeah, we're diligent again, but it does show. But again, though, the ability to not panic and just go, yeah, you know, I've been doing a bit of digging. That the contributor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how long did it last?
Ooh, felt like an age.
Don't know.
It's about half an hour, remember. I think it's about half an hour.
Yeah.
You know what? Just to cover ourselves. Little bit of caveat, half an hour to an hour, something like that. One thing I want to get across about the interview is it might feel that way, or you might even be going into it thinking this, they're not there to trip you up. It's actually, it can be, I mean, it's not pleasant. I was going to say pleasant. That's way off. But what I mean is, but it can be a level-headed discussion. It's not like an apprentice one where Claude's grilling. Yeah, it's not like that. They've genuinely read your stuff, and they're just picking on things, and they're not tripping you up. They're trying to have an intellectual discussion with you. As long as you can converse.
Yeah,
the idea of it is a lot worse than the reality. So it's not that bad once you're in it and it's done. The idea of it beforehand is terrifying.
Yeah, so it's like the doctor's waiting room, isn't it? It's like all the anxiety and all that is sitting outside the waiting.
And they tell you the lump's not there. And then you're fine and you get out.
That's what's happened to you, hasn't it?
It's a different podcast.
Bloody hell. So it's a scary setting. It's a scary setting. The room itself, it felt a little clinical, to be honest, even though it's a nice, it is a bit of a director's box or whatever, but it felt a bit clinical, it felt a bit thingy. And it is, you know, you are sat the other side of a desk and stuff like that. So all the environment and all that is quite intimidating. But generally speaking, when I was in it, they weren't trying to trip you up. But equally, they don't give anything away, actually.
So that's what I was going to say. Did you come out of it then? Sort of knowing your past based on like handshakes and smiles at the end.
You know,
and
I'm one for a pat on the back. I need a little bit of reassurance every now and then that I'm doing things right. And I come out of it going to me, I've got no idea.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But so, because you just don't know. You can tell whether you felt like you dealt with stuff right. But
the way they tell you your past is mad. If you pass, the letter gets sent to your office. And if you fail, it gets sent to your home. So if you get a letter to your office, you've passed.
Yeah, so you're just sitting by the post box in the practice. How long does it take for that to come?
And then what
through?
Happens is everyone starts getting it the same day.
Yeah.
Who you done it with. So and
you're on LinkedIn. You're on LinkedIn. You see everyone going past. It's like, I haven't had a letter.
Where is it?
Mine was on lunch. Mine came at lunch. So they're quite quick with it. They don't torture you. It's within 48, 72 hours. And I was on my lunch, come back, probably with Jack. And I come back. And there was a letter on my desk, and the two directors went, "Oh, there's a bit of news for you." And I was like, "But you know what's scary about that is?" So I actually didn't know that distinction.
No, you don't know at the time, though, do you? You don't. So here's some advice for you: fail house, pass office.
Spoiler there.
Yeah, so you didn't know that actually when you left it delivered. You were still opening it nervous whether you passed or not.
I've only just learned this now from Jack, right?
And the language of it's quite weird. So I read mine, I was like, so have I passed? I don't know.
It doesn't say we're pleased to inform you, does it? Or nothing like that. Language is a bit weird. But you know what was mad at the time was, that's quite heavy news, that, isn't it, in front of the office?
If you were to fail in front of all your peers in the office, that would be a difficult
day. That's a lot to chew on that, isn't it? So that's obviously why they send it home, right? But you say, I didn't know that. So that was a big, big deal, that. Yeah. And then thankfully, passed. And you get it. And you know what? For the graduation of the degree and the graduation of the masters, they felt like hollow victories then, because you knew that the part three was coming. You always knew that there was a final step. For me, that was the first time I properly celebrated.
Yeah.
It's the grandeur of it. You go to London, Portland Place is one of the best buildings in London. And
big ceremony.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's really
good. Like brothers in arms. You've all been through it.
You've
all been on the course together, because it's all done in waves and it's always done in sequences. So everyone's a familiar face.
Yeah.
And you've all been through it together. Such a hard, hard experience.
Yeah.
And then you go out in London, don't you? It's amazing.
Yeah. But I imagine the culmination of that, you know, it must be such a relief as well. You know, you're fully chartered. And is there any processes after that?
You're not chartered at that point.
I was just going to say, what's the process you have to go through after you've finished?
You still have to register.
You get
still
your
have to
qualification,
apply,
you have to apply for the ARB register. Mm. Once you're on the register, well, I think they let you do it. Did he sometimes bypass and let you join REBA because they know you're going to do it, possibly? There's an order to it, isn't there?
Yeah, but either way, the strict order is... And I think, personally, I think RIBA probably does a better job of branding themselves than the ARB, because everyone thinks that it's... Even though the RIBA are the host of the Part 3, the actual point of it is to be registered with the ARB, the Architects Registration Board.
I always feel like the ARB is quite scary.
Yeah.
Because you know that's who you're ultimately you're responsible
for. If you get struck off, it's with the IRB.
Yeah. Whereas Ribéry are nice, friendly, you know.
Ribéry are in effect your union. So, yeah. That's
your. They're on your side almost. Yeah.
Their whole purpose is to advance architects and architecture. That's the point of it. And a little fact as well, by the way, it was something like. It was like 90% of strike-offs are other architects grassed on other architects. Because it's just that world, isn't it? Yeah. Of like, people using the word architect wrong, you know, rather than architectural assistants, they say architect part two. That's actually illegal. Architect is a protected title. So there's loads of that. You get a little sheet, you get a little welcome pack, and there's a few little bits of data in there and all that sort of stuff. So you register with the ARB, you're an architect. Amazing.
Yeah.
And then you register with the RIBA.
You get elected. I think the correct word is you get elected to the RIBA.
Something like that.
It's
And that's how you get your chartership. And as Jack said there, the purpose of the RIBA is you are part of that community, that support network. We've used that support network for legal reasons, copyright reasons, stuff like that, haven't we?
Yeah.
So that's the point of, you know, so you're registered as an architect. You don't need the RIBA, strictly speaking, to practice as an architect because you're registered as with the ARB. The reason you get yourself chartered is that mainly the support network, but it does have a bit more gravitas as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think seeing those logos gives people a lot of confidence, doesn't it?
It does.
Because a lot of people, I think, see Ribéry as the governance and you know, the untrained, if you like, the non-architect clients, you know, they want to know if you're Ribéry chartered, not if you're ARB registered.
No, that's very true.
The importance is the other way around, really, but, you know, probably not the other way around, it's the wrong way of saying it. It's equal, carries equal.
And the best thing is, and Jack taught me this, the best thing is you can calm your email signature down as well.
Yeah.
With you can get rid of BAONs, DIPARCH or MRCH, you get rid of all that and you just put Adam Morgan, RIBA.
Yeah.
And that in itself implies all
everything
the rest.
Else.
Lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's nice. That's
Whereas if you're not qualified, they have email signatures about that long.
Yeah, that's it.
And it's to like the trained eye, you know, they're less trained. But to the untrained eye, they look a lot more trained.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and we're coming to the end now. I've just looked at the time, so we're going to have to start wrapping it up. But I do just want to touch on the journey then past that. So obviously you guys are more than 10 years outside of that now, that process. But when you finish and you go back
10 years,
has anything changed? You know, so you know, you'll feel like you've achieved something, obviously. But when you get back to practice and now you're Ribéry at the end of your email signature, has anything changed or are you still?
Yeah. So because I went in and wanted a pay rise and he went, okay, well, go and run a job.
So you had to run a job then immediately
pay
after
rise,
that?
So,
yeah,
so
yeah.
You get thrown in a bit more at the deep end then, and you
confidence
can't hide
though,
as much.
For me, it's valid. Personally, I say, you know, I'm one for patting the back. For me, passing that was validation that, you know, it's all been worth it, but also you must be good enough. You just must be.
Yeah, you can be trusted almost.
Exactly. But you trust yourself with it a bit more. Mm-hmm. I think. Being an architect and going through the progression of it, you've got that imposter syndrome all the way through it.
Yeah.
All the way through it. You always think everyone else is better than you. And all that, so you always have that mentality. When you pass, I was like, there we go, I'm ready. I've done it. You know, let me at it.
Yeah.
So then I was the same as Jack. I went and just said, okay, let me have a crack then. Let me have a crack at a job. And I asked for like a certain scale. I said nothing more than say a million pound construction value. Just give me something that's relatively straightforward in terms of complexity and value. But I do want to have a go at it because you just have that self-confidence then of I must know what I'm talking about.
And then you realise it's all pinned on your relationship with the lead contractor or the site manager. That's the top and bottom of running
a
job, isn't
a build
it?
Yeah.
So, designing it, but the difference with me is I passed and I had to run a job on site, and it's all about how your relationships are with people. It's not that's
90% of the job. Yeah,
so make friends with the site manager and you're golden.
Life would be so much easier.
Yeah.
So that, well, I was just going to say, because it's almost like the end of one journey and the start of your life as an architect was the start of another, isn't it?
Yeah. So just one little extra one, right? Because we won't do it. There's no point in a full
lesson.
There's
probably a podcast on the next bit, isn't there, to be honest?
We'll get into more practicey stuff, won't we? Yeah. But there is, just for everyone's benefit, because this mightn't be a commonly used term everywhere, that there is such a thing as post-qualified. And it's not like, it's not a qualification, it's not like, it's not an official, it's not what you can get a certificate for. But there is an impression that once someone's being qualified and it's 5 years, you might see this in job applications where it says post-qualified 5 years.
Yeah.
There's no thing of 5 years, no celebration, nothing like that. But it is just this almost tipping point after 5 years. I felt it, not literally on the day, but you do feel like once you've been running projects for 5 years and then onwards, you do feel a bit of a tipping point that you've developed these relationships, you've got your network of consultants, you've got your preferences on certain contractors and all that sort of stuff. So just a little FYI there, that once you're qualified, you're still kind of treated as almost a bit of an advanced graduate. You've still got a little bit to go in convincing others that you're a fully fledged architect. You know, I've seen some put part.
Adam's just swept the rug away from everyone, haven't you? You thought you passed.
Yeah. But it continues, sadly, doesn't it?
I think the majority of people who do pass, though, when they're going to the directors and ask them to lead a project for the first time, you do want someone still looking after you, don't you? You're not going saying, give me any project, I'll smash
and
out
then
the
pure solo. You're saying, let me run in the shadows.
But will you keep an eye on me while I do it and make sure I do this one right? And then the second one, a bit more confidence there.
And then by five years, you then don't need
almost
the comfort
seen
blanket.
It all. That's different scales project.
That's absolutely.
So yeah, that rounds that one off.
That's a wrap.
Yeah, that rounds that off nicely, to be fair. We did have a question from a member, but we actually covered it off during the chat, to be honest.
I was just about to say that, the Q&A. So the question was,
it was from a member of ours who's in a practice and is currently a part two, wanting to do the part three. And they've been in practice for 10 months since they finished the Masters and they're wanting to apply, but they haven't yet got the experience of being senior on a project or being high up in their firm.
Or like latter stages of a project. They're not getting the right opportunities.
So they were lacking in areas. And basically the question was, sounds like they were getting a bit impatient where they're saying, should I stay where I am and hope that they give me that work? Or should I move somewhere else where I know I'll get that work and be able to pass the part three a bit quicker? So they were just asking your advice really on that. But as I say, we covered it off nicely earlier when you actually said, I think at one point,
if they're enjoying it, hang in there. If you're 50-50, maybe do leave. But generally speaking, that experience does naturally come around. I'm not aware of any architect that hasn't delivered something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Generally speaking, it will come around.
Good. All right. Well, thanks again.
Chunky one, that, but we're valuable.
Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about us, head over to arcademia.com.